On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership development. It is broadcast live from WEBR, Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership development, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WEBR, Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. On the Commons with me today are Frank Short, who's in the studio with me, and Richard Maxwell. Richard is an attorney with with Woods Rogers, and he's from the southern part of the state, and he recently won a Supreme Court decision. Rich, thank you so much for joining us today. Could you give us a little background information about your case?
Sure. This is a case about a property owners association named Dogwood Valley Citizens Association. This association is located in Greene County and was formed in the late 60s. It was formed by various deeds of dedication and I think operated fairly successfully for about 20 years. At some point, the officers decided to start imposing special assessments on various projects. And there was quite a bit of dissension amongst some of the lot owners. And subsequently, when those assessments were not paid, they began to foreclose on people's properties. And in many instances, it was pieces of property that people had owned for 20 years and paid dues on those 20 years. And one of the people whose land was sold out from under them, the first they found out about it was when they got a letter from the association returning to them a portion of the purchase price after their property had been sold. And that's when Mr. Winkleman called me and asked if there was something that I could do for him.
And what did you do for him?
Well, the first thing we did was to ask the association if they had sent Mr. Winkleman the proper notice. And they refused to supply us with a copy of the certified mail notice that they supposedly had sent to Mr. Winkleman. Well, that might have deterred a property owner or somebody else who wasn't an attorney, but all it did was just cause us to bring a suit against the Property Owners Association and the people that bought the property, seeking to have the sale overturned and the property put back in the name of Mr. Winkleman.
And I'm having some problems over here with the board. Rich, you actually ended up taking this to the Supreme Court.
That's correct, Shu. We first tried the matter in the Circuit Court for Greene County. At that time, we had advanced various theories by which we thought that Mr. Winkleman was entitled to get his property back. The first of these was that the price that was paid for it was unconscionably low.
How much was it?
Well, they paid about $2,500 for property that was worth $20,000.
Now, he had two lots. Was this for both lots, or was this for just one lot?
The price for one of the lots was $1,000, and the price for the other one was about $1,500. That's what was paid.
Wow.
And the assessed value for one lot was about $12,000, and the assessed value for the other lot was about $8,000. But what really bothered me was the fact that it was sold because they claimed that he hadn't paid a $35 assessment.
This was a special assessment, right?
This was a special assessment, and it was also particularly troublesome because their accounting and their notices weren't really clear about what were regular assessments, what were special assessments. And Mr. Winkleman had been paying some money, and at that time he was sick, and he thought he had paid everything, but apparently he didn't. And while they claimed that they sent him notice, he claimed that he never got the notice that was supposedly sent to him. Now, there were also other problems that we saw with this. The first one was that the Homeowners Association had a bylaw which required 90 days before they would take any action after filing a memorandum of lien on the property. And they sold the property well before that time. The other issue was that we found in the Virginia Code that the section which permits a homeowners association to sell property because a lien assessment was not paid provides that only a unit can be sold. And a unit is defined in the Virginia Code as a condominium unit. But what Mr. Winkleman had was a lot, and that was separately defined in the Act. So we argued to the court that the Homeowners Association, if someone didn't pay an assessment, could only sell that property if it was a condominium unit. The final point that we argued to the court was that this Homeowners Association did not qualify as a Homeowners Association under the Virginia Property Owners Association Act. It's many times called the POAA. What the POAA does is give homeowners associations the ability to make special assessments. A general assessment is what is provided for in the deed of dedication, where the property is dedicated to the homeowners association. The rights and responsibilities of property owners are set forth in that document, and the general assessment in that is usually modest. In this case, it was $10, but the POAA gives the governing body of the homeowners association the ability to make special assessments, repair roads, clear land, fix dams, those things like that. However, the act it came into effect, and when it came into effect, there were many homeowners associations already in existence, and the act set certain requirements for those homeowners associations that were already in existence to be able to qualify to make these special assessments. And there was an earlier Supreme Court case of Lake Arrowhead, in which the Supreme Court said to qualify as a property owners association under the Virginia Property Owners Association Act, there needed to be within your documents that were recorded an express obligation to maintain the premises. And we argued to the Greene County Circuit Court that while there was a lot of language in deeds of dedication which talked about their duty was to do that, there was nothing in there that expressly said that they had to maintain those. There was language that they would maintain it to the extent there was money available, or that was the purpose that the assessments were to be used for. But there was nothing in there that obligated that association to perform that in a contractually binding way. And what Judge Bowden of the Greene County Circuit Court said was that in reviewing all of the documents, he viewed the homeowner's documents as creating an express duty. So we did prevail on that part. He also held that the fact that they proceeded sooner than their own bylaws provided, that is sooner than the 90 days, did defeat the sale, and he also had held the sale wasn't unconscionable. But he did find that the statute says that you can only sell a unit, not a lot. And he said the legislature knew what they were doing when they put that provision in there. And so he found for Mr. Winkleman and required the property to be retitled into Mr. Winkleman's name. But, of course, the story doesn't end there. The Dogwood Valley Citizens Association appealed that ruling, which I guess was a little bit of a surprise to me, because there's a real risk in doing that, in that if you appeal that decision and the Supreme Court were to find that, in fact, they did not qualify as a homeowners association, it would throw the whole organization into chaos, because all these special assessments that had been made were invalid and would also prohibit the association from making future special assessments, which I assessed to be a huge risk from the view of the Property Owners Association.
Would you have appealed that?
I'm sorry, Sue.
Would you have appealed that? If
would
it
I
were you?
Appealed it? No, I wouldn't have appealed it. But I was coming at it from a little bit different view. First of all, my clients did not have a lot of money. This isn't a big property owners association with lots of valuable land. It's a sort of called a mom and pop subdivision homeowners association nestled up in the mountains of Greene County.
You know, when I talked to you the other day, you sort of lamented the fact that when you actually got to the Supreme Court, that they just focused on the one issue as to whether or not the association fell under the POA, and they did not reach the other questions, whether or not, the associations are allowed to sell lots or units, which would only be condominiums.
Well, that's a problem many times that you face with appellate courts, is that if there are four issues and they might find for you on all four, if they find on one that deals with all of the others and makes it unnecessary for them to find on that, they're going to do that because it doesn't paint them into a corner that they might have to modify their position in a future case. And as an attorney, if you're defending a case in the Supreme Court and you get a victory, you're not going to be too critical about the nature of that victory. You're just happy, especially as I was for the Winklemans, who had fought so hard and had their property taken from them, that the Supreme Court had ratified the position that we had taken below. My partner, Frank Friedman, who actually argued the case before the Supreme Court, had indicated that it was the most interesting experience that he has ever had in arguing any number of cases before the Supreme Court, in that the Supreme Court, during the argument, intimated to him that, in fact, that they would have found for us on every ground that we advanced. However, they also indicated they didn't believe that this association was a property owners association entitled to make special benefits, special assessments under the POAA. And therefore, it really wasn't a surprise to us that they found as they did. It would have been interesting to have the decision affirmed on the basis that they could only sell a unit and not a lot. But I guess maybe that issue will be resolved for another day.
Mr. Maxwell, this is Frank Short. I'm in the studio with Shu, and I've been working with Shu on issues like this for more years than we can count. First of all, congratulations on a great win down there in the Supreme Court. And I'd like to pick up on the point you just made about the oral argument. And as you know, very often you get a sense from the questions the court asks where we may be going in this area. And I realize you didn't make the argument yourself, but based on what you heard from your partner, what type of predictions might you be able to make about how the Supreme Court of Virginia might regard non-judicial foreclosures by property owners associations?
Well, I think that a lot of that issue falls into the specific facts of any case. In this case, we had one assessment that was for $35 against somebody that had owned the property for 20 years and had paid assessments all through that time. And the property was sold for that. If you change the facts around, and let's say it was multiple assessments over 6 months, a year, that hadn't been paid, and it had gotten up to $2,500, and the person had gotten lots of notices and never responded to any of them, I think that the Supreme Court might have taken a different look at the case. It probably would have reached the same result because I think it was bound to. But that type of case wouldn't have the appeal to someone like me as an attorney to take it on, because I can tell you when you take on these cases, there's no way that one individual like the Winkelmans could pay for the amount of legal time that it took to research, to find out all the facts. Because remember, the Property Owners Association has all the books, they have all the records, etc., and they've got a fund of money to draw from to pay their attorney's fees. So it's very difficult for the individual to do that. Getting back to your question, we got the sense that in that question of between a unit and a lot, our sense is that they would have followed what Judge Bowden of Greene County said, was that the legislature specifically said a unit, and the legislature knew the difference between what a unit was and what a lot is, because the same language permitting the sale of a unit for assessments is in the Condominium Act.
You also have the sense that they would have sided with you on the unconscionability argument, given the sympathetic plaintiff that you brought to him.
I think so, but it's all sort of mixed up in together with how the association acted in this case and the fact that they didn't even follow the prescription in their own bylaws about how long they would take before they sold the property. It's always a dicey issue when you go and make that equitable argument and say it was unconscionable for them to do that. Frank, as you may know, that argument was made in some old cases dealing with foreclosure sales of property under a deed of trust. And the Supreme Court has backed away from that a little bit in more recent cases and looked more closely at the notice that people have gotten. And if they have received appropriate notice, they're going to believe that it's got to be a bigger disparity between what the price was paid versus what the property was worth than probably what it would be in these cases where the Winkelmans, if they got notice, it was unclear as to what they got, and it wasn't clear that they understood it, and it wasn't clear that the association went through a methodical process to make double sure that all these people knew that their property was coming up for sale.
Mm-hmm. Did your action include a request for attorney fees under 55-515 of the POA on the basis that you were the prevailing party in what amounted to an action to enforce the governing documents?
Yeah, we did ask the court for that, although it was made at the end of a period in which the judge had announced his decision. I think it was a tough decision for him, and I don't think that he really focused on that section of the code, which provides that the prevailing party will do that. Subsequent to the decision in the Supreme Court, I have now filed another motion for attorney's fees, asking Judge Bowden to allow both the appellate fees and the fees in the underlying case, both based both upon the fact that there's that provision in the code section that says if you're the prevailing party on an issue dealing with lien assessments, that you're entitled to your reasonable fees, plus just the equity of the situation.
How about the reaction of the industry? There has just been a staggering silence from the trade associations and others who, whenever they win, you immediately hear it trumpeted. But when a homeowner, when a consumer wins against an association, you don't find anything. We had to actually spend a lot of time digging this thing out, and I haven't been able to find a reported Greene County case to this day. Was it in fact reported?
It was not reported. Judge Boughton did a very, very thorough analysis of it, but he decided to read his decision into the record at a hearing. Now, it took him probably 20 minutes to read in his decision, and he had notes that he was working off, and I think he was also, some of it was extemporaneous. And I forget exactly how many pages the transcript was, but it was like 10 pages. And in fact, he probably gave as good a decision orally as many times you see from a written decision. But unfortunately, it's not published because he actually did quite a scholarly job in analyzing the situation.
What did you run into when you got to the Supreme Court in the way of amicus briefs from trade associations? As you know, the Community Association Institute trumpets their amicus briefs, and they actually have a panel of litigators that will show up around the country to defend associations. Did you run into anything like that in the Winkleman case?
Fortunately, no. And because of that reason, I tried to keep, at least from my side, the decision of the Greene County Circuit Court very quiet. I didn't want to trumpet that decision, anything, until I knew whether or not there was going to be an appeal, because I was afraid of that. It had been hard enough to win this battle below, and the thought of having to face more skilled lawyers with money behind them was something that I didn't want to look forward to in the Supreme Court.
Well, I don't blame you. It's tough to it's tough to get a consumer protection issue adequately represented. And again, you know, my hat's off to you for the job you did for your client in this case. Do you sense that there may be a lot of other associations out there, given the very narrow scope of the ruling here, limited to the express recorded duty of the association to perform maintenance obligations? I can think of lots of associations, big associations, where that duty may not be expressly recorded. And if the Virginia Supreme Court said it once in the opinion, they must have said it four times.
Frank, I don't have the code in front of me, but as I recall, that only applies to associations prior to 1976, I believe. I think I'm correct in that associations after 1976 are automatically included in the POAA.
That may be, but there's a lot of old ones.
Yeah, oh, believe me, there are a lot of old ones, and I bet most of them not have that the specific language that the Supreme Court requires.
So maybe they'll get to decide, or the homeowners will get to decide, whether they really want to be a property owners association, you think?
Well, I think that these cases, and this is a horror case, and there's others ones up there, go not so much to the homeowners association per se, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. I think it deals with the way it's operated, and that if you have people that are elected that are sensitive to those issues, but also sensitive to the fact that there are items for the common good up there, that you're going to find that you're not going to have these problems, because in most instances you're going to have consensus, and where you don't have consensus, at least you're going to have mostly unanimity, and you're going to have an organization that takes time to make sure that it sends out proper notices of its assessments, make sure that those are clear, and then make sure when somebody doesn't pay that they have lots of notice that they haven't paid. And I think the association that does that is not, whether they qualify under the POAA or not, they're not going to face someone that's going to take them to court. I mean, this case would never have gone to court if this association had sent me a copy of their notice.
Is the real underlying problem here the ability to use non-judicial foreclosure in the first place?
I mean,
isn't the Homeowners Association in the same place as any other business with regard to the ability to collect funds from somebody who owes money to the business? They've got, as I see it, all the recourses available to bring an action, obtain a judgment, levy against the judgment, and non-judicial foreclosure may be just too big a weapon, given the disparity of power, the deep pockets of the association. It may be just too big a weapon to give these associations. What's your opinion on that?
Well, maybe. As we were analyzing the language in the code that permits only the sale of units and trying to determine the justification for the legislature in doing that, we focused on the typical condominium unit as opposed to a lot. And I think there's a better argument for the non-judicial sale in the condominium unit context, because in there you have horizontal living, and it really is the ability of that association to provide necessary services that affects everybody. And if a quarter of the people weren't paying their association dues, it might prohibit the association from getting the necessary insurance that it needs, making repairs to the building, and doing other things that are absolutely necessary.
Yeah, that certainly has been the trade association line, that, you know, the sky is going to fall unless we've got this enormous weapon to use against homeowners.
I guess the other argument that they would make is that, let's say that someone doesn't pay the assessments and it gets to be $1,000. And if you took away the ability to sell the unit for those assessments without going to court, you force the association to have to go into a court on a $1,000 judgment and bring what is they call a creditor's bill to sell that unit. And having gone through that process on real estate, which was worth substantially more than that, it's a time-consuming process. It requires a lot of attorney's fees, because you need an attorney to help you with that process. And at the end, you've got to conduct the sale with those attendant expenses. So I think that you can argue that in the poorly run association, it creates a situation where someone can get dispossessed of their property without ever having a court taking a look at it. On the other side, if you have a good association and you've got bad actors that just aren't paying their fair share, is it fair to make the association and the other owners have to go through the whole process of bringing an action in court to take away someone's property? Now, having seen the negative of this and the abuse of it, I'm leaning much more towards saying that maybe the Homeowners Association shouldn't have this power, because the risk of someone being dispossessed of their property who has been paying dues for a long time is so great that we shouldn't take that risk.
Yeah, the old expediency versus due process.
And with that, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Rich. I hope you'll come back, because I understand you've picked up some additional cases off of this case.
Well, I've had several calls from people whose cases come up with various variations on the same fact pattern, and that is that they never got notice. And I haven't had the chance to investigate it yet. I guess the final comment that I'd make is that this is just a nightmare, because imagine that the truly innocent person that goes to one of these sales and buys a piece of property thinking that he's bought this thing fair and square, and he goes in and makes improvements to that property, and 5, 6, 7 years later, he comes back to find that, in fact, the sale was not proper.
It was void, yeah.
And then who wins? Is it the landowner who got dispossessed of his property, or is it the purchaser who, in good faith, bought it and made improvement to it? I think we're gonna be seeing what the answer to that is, and it's one of those no-win situations.
Well, Rich, thanks again. I promised you that I would have you out of here. I know that you're on your way to Richmond. I want to thank you very much for joining us. I do hope you will come back.
I'd love to.
You have a lot of fans up here in Northern Virginia.
You sure do. So for the rest of you, don't go away. We'll be back, and we'll be looking at pending legislation in Virginia.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. On the Commons with me today is Frank Short. Frank's in the studio, and we will be looking at pending legislation. These are bills that your legislators have proposed and may very well become the law. Right, Frank?
That's right, Shu.
And what have we got today? What are we going to be looking at? What are there any consumer protections in here, Frank? Or?
Well, yes, there are. But before we get to the good, the bad, and the ugly, let's take a look at a very important section of the POA as it exists today, and then we'll talk about how a piece of pending legislation may be very bad for homeowners and consumers who are trying to get information about what's going on in their community association. The POA as it exists today in 55510.1 B, that's a section entitled Meetings of the Board of Directors. The POA says, unless otherwise exempt as relating to an executive session pursuant to subsection C, at least one copy of all agenda packets and materials furnished to members of an association's board of directors for a meeting shall be made available for inspection by the membership of the association at the same time such documents are furnished to the members of the board of directors. This is a very, very important provision that we've got in the Property Owners Association Act. It means that if you're getting ready to go to a board meeting, you have the opportunity, you have the legal right, before that meeting convenes, to insist that the association show you the agenda packet and any materials furnished to members of the board of directors, unless those materials are specifically exempt based on a recognized privilege. And that allows you, for example, to see draft minutes. It allows you to see proposed policy resolutions. It allows you to see the things that the association is getting ready to do. Why is this so important? Well, because under another provision of the POA, the association must afford you, as a homeowner, the right to speak at an association meeting. And in order to intelligently exercise that right to speak, you've got to be able to find out what it is that's on that agenda, what it is they're going to be talking about, and how it might affect you. Then you can intelligently go in and address the board and your other homeowners, your fellow homeowners who attend that meeting, about the merits or the lack of merit in any proposed resolution. Unfortunately, we have a piece of legislation in front of the Virginia legislature right now. It's House Bill 894, and the patron is
Mark Sickles.
Mark Sickles of the 43rd District. Shu will talk in a moment because she's been in touch with Mr. Sickles about this bill. And this bill would change the POA to say in pertinent part that your right to examine association books or records is limited. You can't see anything that is a draft not yet incorporated into the association's books or records. So, for example, draft minutes would be out. Draft policy resolutions would be out. Draft rules and regulations would be out. The key things that you might want to address on matters that are immediately before the board would no longer be available for your inspection before a board meeting. This would make it much more difficult for you to intelligently exercise your right to speak. If in Virginia we had the same law applicable to the Virginia legislature that Mr. Sickles has proposed for homeowners associations, I wouldn't have been able to look at House Bill 894 because it hasn't been enacted and signed by the governor yet.
Good point. So you wouldn't be able to put your thoughts on there, right?
That's right. Now, Mr. Sickles is a Democrat, and what's surprising is that Democrats often hold themselves out as, you know, the Consumer Protection Party. And this is very, very disappointing. And, Shu, why don't you tell us about your conversation with Mr. Sickles on this?
Oh, I'd love to tell you about it. You're on the Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew. We're talking to Frank Short during the second hour, and we're talking about pending legislation in Virginia. We're talking right now specifically about House Bill number 894, and the patron of this particular bill is Mark Sickles. And Mark Sickles would like very much to make sure that nothing that is in draft form would be available for homeowner inspection before it has been approved and adopted by the board. I called Mr. Sickles, and he very kindly returned my call. He is, as many of you may know, right now down in Richmond. And he sort of was, you know, Frank, I don't want to say he was rude or aggressive. He was defensive, definitely defensive when I talked to him. I said I wanted to ask him why he felt it important to amend this. He said, he said, well, I think you would all agree that a secretary has a right to make sure that her comments were accurate before they were made available. I said, and that means that the board would adopt it, right? Yes. And I said, well, what about the homeowner who goes in and speaks maybe in front of the board? And isn't that homeowner allowed to have the same courtesy to make sure that his or her comments are accurate? And he said, oh, well, we'd make sure that that was available. Oh, really? And then went on to say, supposing we had a policy resolution. I mean, right now, the way this is written, a draft policy resolution could be withheld. Oh, no, 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 that would never happen. I said, well, based on what you've got here, Mark, it certainly can happen. He says, look, he says, these are democracies. There are many democracies. He says, you have voted and elected these board members to act for you. I said, you and know as well as I do, but that's called comfort, that these elections are not quite as, you know, above board as you would like us to believe they are. I know of a lot of election fraud that goes on. So then he told me, well, he says, we've reworded it. He says, that's been changed. It's gone to committee, and he says, we've got language that I think is going to keep everyone happy. He says, go to the website, and you will find the new language.
And what did we do earlier this afternoon?
Well, I checked it last night, and it says that it had been referred to committee, but there was nothing out of the committee. And right before coming to the studio, Frank, you came to my house, and we whipped out my little handy-dandy computer, and we went to it, and there still was nothing on the computer.
There has been no change, folks, made available online to the language that we read to you, which is to the effect that if this is a draft, that it is not a final record of the association, then you have no right to see it. And if Mr. Sickles has changed it, or if somebody else has changed it, that would be very interesting to see. We'll reserve judgment on whether the change is meritorious or not till after we can look at it. But right now, if it has been changed, that's not reflected at all in what's available online. Now, this has been referred, House Bill 894 has been referred to the House General Laws Committee of the Virginia House of Delegates. That committee, in turn, has referred it to Subcommittee Number 1, which has jurisdiction over housing. Now, the members of that subcommittee, the first people who will be marking up Mr. Sickles' House Bill 894, are the following. Delegates Drake, Suit, S-U-I-T, Rapp, R-A-P-P, Oder, O-D-E-R, Delegate D.W. Marshall, Delegate Barlow, B-A-R-L-O-W, and Delegate Hall, H-U-L-L. According to information at the Virginia House Delegates website, this subcommittee will meet on Tuesday, January 27th, at which we may have a markup of House Bill 894. If you are interested, if you live in a homeowners association in Virginia, and you want to be able to have access to everything that's going to a board of directors, all non-privileged material, then you may want to call that subcommittee of the General Laws Committee, Subcommittee Number 1 on Housing, and you may want to express your views on the effect of House Bill 894 on consumer protection in homeowners associations. Because, as we just heard from Richard Maxwell, there's a real disparity of power between the association and an individual homeowner. There is no state agency that any of us can go to complain when a homeowners association doesn't comply with the POA. And our greatest right as homeowners and consumers is to inform ourselves of what the board is doing and what they're getting ready to do. And in order to do that, access to books and records is mandatory. It's absolutely essential.
If you would like to give Mark Sickles a call, I've got his phone number with me. In Richmond, it's 804-698-1043.
You be sure to tell him that we said hello.
Yes, tell him you heard about this on the Commons.
And tell him that you're going to be hearing a lot more about it if this bill doesn't get substantially modified for the better, for the interest of consumer protection.
Well, interestingly enough, he is on some consumer protection panel someplace.
Nice.
Isn't he?
Mr. Sickles is from Fairfax County. He's down from the area around Springfield Mall.
Actually, I think, yeah, he's in the Kingstown area, and incidentally, I have a number of listeners, regular listeners, who live in Kingstown, and I have been in touch with a number of them. If you live in Kingstown and he is your representative, Again, his number is 804-698-1043. That's down in Richmond. And his office number up here in Fairfax County is 703-317-0036. Please call him and tell him that he's been hoodwinked, he's got a bad bill here, that he needs to protect his constituents, and tell him that you heard about it on the Commons. You're on the Commons with Frank Short and Sue Bartholomew. Okay, Frank, what else is
there? Well, we have a good bill.
All right.
This is the patron of this bill is State Senator Houck, H-O-U-C-K, and this is Senate Bill 348. As many of you may know, last year the Virginia legislature changed the Condominium Act, and they changed it with regard to access to meetings of the board of directors by homeowners. And they made a very significant change. By way of background, what a lot of boards have been doing, because homeowners have the right to attend board meetings, is they have been trying to sidestep that open meeting requirement by creating subcommittees, special committees, and delegating a lot of the actual discussion and research to those subcommittees, so that by the time this matter reaches the board of directors, they've got something that is going to that everybody has basically signed up to it, and you know the homeowners will be in an even weaker position when they try to come in and talk to the board and get their views across. The intent of the open meeting rule and the Property Owners Association Act is that before making a decision, the board ought to be able to, or the board ought to be required to listen to what the homeowners have to say about what they're getting ready to do. And when we changed the Condo Act last year, it required that the meetings of these subcommittees, any special committee of the board of directors, be open to homeowners, and they had the same right to receive notice of those meetings as they did to receive notice of meetings of the board of directors itself, so that the smoke-filled room politics would be harder as a practical matter to execute in condos. Unfortunately, last year there was no proposal to make a corresponding change to the Property Owners Association Act, so this protection was afforded only to those who live in condominiums.
But they get to get their units foreclosed on, so that's...
Yeah, I guess that's a trade-off, too. I forgot that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, under Senate Bill 348, we would have parallel language regarding the requirements for open meetings and requirements for notice to meetings, not only of the full board of directors, but any subcommittee or other committee thereof. And so homeowners will be able to find out what's going on, whether it's by the full board of directors or subcommittees. There's just all kinds of, you know, backroom shenanigans that go on in the decision-making process in these associations. And sometimes you don't even have subcommittees. Sometimes what happens is you have back-and-forth emails. And all of this discussion that's supposed to take place in front of the homeowners, so that you can watch what the board's doing and hold your people accountable. Mini democracies, as Mark Sickles likes to call it, so that that democratic process can work. Actually, as Shu and I have heard, and as CAI will be very quick to tell you, a homeowners association is a democracy on one day a year. What day is that, Shu?
That's election day, but you know what? They even screw around with the elections, Frank. So, I mean, that's not much of a democracy, is it?
Yeah. But that's just the way it is, folks. We have, you know, no separation of powers, no system of checks and balances, no state agency with jurisdiction over these entities, and they get more and more powerful, and they're being given more power all the time by the Virginia legislature. Not because homeowners are asking for it, but because a trade association of
Larry Curley and Moe.
Yeah, it's the association law firms. It's the property management companies. They come down there because, you know, any time a homeowner is given rights, it makes ripples in their little ponds, folks. They don't like that.
Well, gee, I wonder why, Frank. So, you know, again, guys, if you're going to be calling, you know, you want this one to pass by Hauk, and if you are represented by Hauk, you know, he doesn't seem to be a bad guy.
Call him up and thank him. That's Senate Bill 348. The patron is State Senator Hauk, H-O-U-C-K. And maybe Mr. Hauk and Mr. Sickles can have a little conversation about the merits of Mr. Sickles' bill. And he might amend his views somewhat.
Maybe we ought to have Mr. Sickle on here sometime.
That would be just a spectacular idea. I'd love to talk to Mr. Sickles.
All right. Well, that maybe that can be arranged if he'll come on. Okay. We got any more, Frank?
Well, there's a as many of you who have followed this issue for a while are familiar with the role played by State Senator Mims as a real advocate for consumer protection. And Senator Mims has a bill, Senate Bill 503, that would address both the Condominium Act and the Property Owners Association Act on the issue of nonjudicial foreclosure, exactly the subject about which we had our discussion with Mr. Maxwell. In the limited time remaining, we don't have enough time to go into the details of Senator Mims' bill, but Senate Bill 503, I encourage you to look it up. It is a pro-homeowners bill. It doesn't go as far as I would like it to go with regard to nonjudicial foreclosure protections. I think, personally, and I've felt like this for a long time, that it ought to be illegal for an association to attempt nonjudicial foreclosure to collect a fine imposed by the association. To me, that is just the height of arrogance and the height of denial of due process for an association to be empowered by law to run its own kangaroo court system, impose a fine on a homeowner in a process with no due process at all, and then use nonjudicial foreclosure to collect the fine. This is begging for abuse, and it's begging for, if not a statutory overturn, then an overturn in the Virginia Supreme Court. As we're seeing, use of nonjudicial foreclosure to collect a fine has been made illegal in California, in Texas. I believe it's getting ready to be made illegal in Arizona, Sue. Are you?
I think that Eddie Farnsworth has been trying to do that. I think that you're going to see that in Florida as well. And a lot of these legislators across the country, and we're going to be listening, we're going to be hearing from them because they're going to be on the show and they're going to be talking about what they're doing. But this is something, there seems to be a bit of a tide going across the country right now.
Oh, yeah, and Shu and I have talked to our own legislator, Delegate Dillard, about this, and we've talked to Michelle McQuigg about it. And when you talk to the delegates, they didn't know.
They don't understand what happened.
They really didn't know the effect of the law, and that's because CAI was very shrewd in the way they got this through. First, they empowered associations to fine. Then, years later, they came back and empowered nonjudicial foreclosure to collect assessments. And last but not least, they came back and they said, well, you can nonjudicially foreclose to collect a fine. But you have to look at several different places.
What they did was they called a fine an assessment.
Yes.
That's what, and then they said, oh, you've already got the right to collect a fine. So all you do is you call a fine an assessment, and you're off and running.
That's right.
You don't need to do that. You don't need permission.
And, you know, that is begging for some consumer protection, first in the legislature and then, if necessary, in the courts.
Frank, thank you so much. It's always fun having you in the studio with me. I always enjoy it.
Enjoyed being here.
And for the rest of you, I thank you for joining us. Watch what your legislators are doing because they're hearing from some people, they'd better be hearing from you as well. Stay on the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Stay tuned and stay free.
It's my land. Keep your rules up for me. It's my land. America, home of the free. I paid in full.